In his new novel, The Finkler Question, British author Howard Jacobson introduces us to a character named Julian Treslove. He's a Gentile who happens to have a strange obsession with Jews and Jewishness, and a particular Jew named Sam Finkler.
Before he met Finkler, Treslove had never met a Jew, not knowingly at least. He supposed a Jew would be like the word Jew, small and dark and beetling, a secret person.
But not Sam Finkler. To the contrary, he's big in body and in character. Treslove is entranced, jealous, really, of his friend's Jewishness. He imagines the Jews live more deeply, more passionately. Finkler, on the other hand, takes an opposite view. He's a vocal opponent of the State of Israel, a prism through which he can escape his Jewishness. Howard Jacobson's comic novel, you might call it bitterly comic, won this year's Man Booker Prize. It's the highest literary award for fiction in Britain. And when I spoke with Howard Jacobson recently, he described his characters, Finkler and Treslove, and the differences between being Jewish in Britain and America.
The whole point of having Treslove was to make some comedy out of how Jewishness looks to somebody who isn't a Jew. I mean, we often have how Jewishness looks to somebody who isn't a Jew and who hates Jews. And in a book where there is some of that, I wanted the opposite too. I wanted how does Jewishness look to somebody who really adores Jews and so exaggerates, you know, their more lovable qualities.
Sam Finkler is a pop philosopher. He's a well-known radio personality in Britain. He shows people how Schopenhauer could help people with their love lives or Hegel with their holiday arrangements. And as you say, he's not just critical of Israel. He happens to hate everything about the Jewish state. I mean, he goes, as you write, so far to join this group of British Jews who call themselves ashamed. They call for boycotts against the state and so on. I mean, is he an archetype? Is Sam Finkler an anomaly in modern Britain?
No, I mean, there are a lot of Sam Finklers, which is why I invented him. I invented him out of what I felt I saw. They would, of course, deny it. But there is a virulence at the moment about Israel in England. When I was writing this novel, and this was one of the impulses behind the writing of the novel, to investigate this, many Jews that I knew, rational, calm Jews, were truly wondering whether England was going to go on being the safe haven for them that it's been for a long time. Not the kind of safe haven America is for Jews, where a Jew in America feels he's absolutely of the American culture and plays his part in the founding of and the moulding of and the recreation of American culture. Slightly more distant. Distant but safe, it seemed, until the last few years, when it might not be that it's unsafe on the streets, though it has been unsafe on the streets for some, when things get particularly hot in the Middle East, during the blockade, the Gaza blockade and so on. But even when that's not the case, it's just the temperature of the newspapers. It can be very wearing to Jewish nerves to have this bombardment all the time.
Is it possible that Sam Finkler, who of course is the Finkler in the Finkler question, and the real Jewish opponents of Israel in Britain, people like him, are simply sort of exercising a kind of tough love approach? Or do you see something else happening?
Well, some are, but Finkler isn't. I mean, I could have, and there are some people who flit in and out of the book who are. And some would say, and I think it's a very, very fair thing to say, that to be a friend of Israel is to be critical of Israel. But there's something else about Finkler that I go for in this book and that accounts for some of the book's comic anger at this stage, and that's the whole business of being ashamed. What annoys me about that is not their politics, but the idea that what's happening somewhere else is about them. It's the vanity of it. It's the egoism. It's the parading of their it's the wearing their hearts on their sleeve. It's this carnival of conscience that I make fun of in the book. Not the political position at all, which in some cases is perfectly reasonable. It's the fact that, you know, I feel this. I feel this in my heart. It's my story. It's about me.
I'm speaking with British novelist Howard Jacobson. His latest book is called The Finkler Question. It was recently awarded Britain's Man Booker Prize for fiction. Howard Jacobson, I read that you were not raised in a particularly observant Jewish home. You barely stepped into a synagogue, if I have that correct.
Yes, that's correct.
And I gather your intention was never to write about the Anglo-Jewish experience. It just sort of ended up that way in many of your novels. Do you think that you will sort of step away from that from that theme?
Well, I keep trying to. This book surprised me because I thought... I wrote a novel once called The Mighty Waltzer, which is about playing table tennis, actually. It's about being Jewish and being table and playing table tennis. And then I wrote a novel called Kaluki Nights, which was intensely Jewish. It had the word Jew on every line. It was a novel about being obsessed with being Jew. I mean, every line was Jew, 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 joke, 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 why. Obsession was its subject. And I thought that was that. And then somehow this novel came along, and it took me by surprise too. But you're right to have said that I never began as thinking of myself as a Jewish writer at all. It astonished my family and my friends when I wrote about Jews. I never really knew very much about it. I'm still a bit of a Treslov, actually. This could be where Treslov comes from. I'm still a bit of a Gentile looking with my nose pressed in against the window of Jewishness, thinking, how fantastic, what great jokes they make. Look how wild they are. Look how warm they are. Look how deeply they love. And so I am a touch like that still.
That's British novelist Howard Jacobson. His latest book, The Finkler Question, was recently awarded Britain's Man Booker Prize for Fiction. Howard Jacobson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And you can hear Howard Jacobson read more from his novel at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Picture a computer hacker. Got an image? You think they're doing something criminal, right? Well, how's this? More than 1,000 software engineers and other tech workers met in 21 spots around the world this past weekend. They were taking part in a humanitarian effort called Random Hacks of Kindness. Hacking actually means tinkering, and these folks were using their skills to do good. Reporter Kaomi Getz met some of them in New York.
It's safe to say it's pretty unusual for Microsoft, Google, and Yahoo to partner on anything. But at the New York gathering, a number of their employees mingled with each other, as well as global leaders. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was there and admitted being a little out of his element.
Like some of our colleagues here today from NASA, I'm not a rocket scientist, as you know. I may be the last person to talk about high-tech, what's going on now.
But the UN presence underscores how interested large humanitarian organizations are in getting help from the tech community. The latest example of this is Random Hacks of Kindness, a two-day hackathon happening in different cities around the world. It's a competition where software developers get a chance to hack or apply their skills to solve problems that arise during humanitarian crises. They use open source technology that's public and collaborative. That means engineers for Google and Microsoft, at least here, can work side by side. Patrick Svenberg is a director for Microsoft and a co-founder of Random Hacks of Kindness. He says it was a little risky at first.
We threw all cautions to the wind, and we, you know, got a group of people together in November of 2009 at the first hackathon at Silicon Valley. Had about 100 people show up. I didn't get fired. Nobody got fired.
And in just two subsequent events, participation has exploded. When a crisis like a flood or a devastating earthquake hits, aid groups are often working in the dark. They need reliable data maps. Where are the people? What are the problems? New technology lets aid workers analyze what's going on in real time and make better decisions faster. Sarah Farmer makes those maps. She used to work for a military contractor. Now she helps people facing natural disasters.
A lot of people who were involved in the Haiti and the Chile and the Pakistan responses, we discovered that the skills that we had made a massive difference to people. I mean, literally saved lives.
In a college auditorium in Manhattan, hackers with projects made pitches to try to get help from others for the next 2 days. They formed teams. Whiteboards, laptops, and lots of caffeine appeared for the next 30-plus hours of hacking. They were all hoping to produce a result like developer Andy Gupp. Last year, he created software that picked up messages from Twitter to pinpoint crisis hotspots. It was immediately used in Haiti and continues to be by dozens of agencies.
In the dark ages, 2 to 5 years ago, it would have taken a long time to deploy these applications. Now we're seeing applications that help these people immediately, and they're built within sometimes hours, days, or weeks at most.
The event awarded prizes like smartphones and flip cams for the top hacks. Winners also got praise from their peers and some free beer. The real reward, they know, will come later. For NPR News, I'm Kayomi Getz in New York.
You're listening to NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Melissa Block. The climate meeting in Cancun is beginning its second week. Heads of state are conspicuously absent, and attendance is way down from last year's meeting in Copenhagen. Also, expectations are low for a new international treaty. So environmental activists and climate scientists are looking for bite-sized solutions to curb global warming, as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
Last year's United Nations meeting in Copenhagen was supposed to deliver the blueprints for a new treaty to curb climate change. The current Kyoto Treaty expires in 2 years. Instead, the UN delivered practically nothing. At Cancun, the head of the UN's climate agency, Cristiana Figueres, opened the meeting with both a warning and a liberal dose of wishful thinking.
No one can afford permanently immovable positions. Nobody can afford to stay in inaction. And it is very clear that countries are actually willing to engage to produce a result here in Cancun.
The result will clearly not include a new international treaty with the U.S. and other big greenhouse gas emitters on board. Alden Meyer is a seasoned climate negotiator from the Union of Concerned Scientists.
The reality is that there's no international forum that's going to be able to force the U.S., China, India, the other big players to do something that they perceive as not in their national interest.
So climate activists are looking for more realistic commitments. They're talking about a $100 billion a year fund from rich countries to help developing nations adapt to climate change and some way to transfer greener energy technology as well. But Ken Green, an environmental scientist from the American Enterprise Institute, says even that's not going to fly.
The international framework has always rested on a fundamentally fatally flawed idea that developed countries are going to transfer voluntarily unprecedented amounts of wealth to the developing world, along with turning over technology, including intellectual property.
Some big polluters aren't waiting for handouts or directions from the UN. Dan Lashoff is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Countries, particularly countries like China and India, are doing things to cut emissions that they're not prepared to sign up for as part of an international treaty right now. We need to recognize that it's what they're actually doing that matters.
China in particular has set ambitious goals to cut emissions of greenhouse gases. President Barack Obama has too. He's promised a 17% cut below 2005 levels over the next 10 years. But legislation to cut emissions died in Congress this year. Environmentalists like Mark Tursek, who runs the Nature Conservancy, says that was bad, but not the end of the world.
With the loss of the climate bill, environmentalists had a big setback. It's not all bad. It's good in this job to be humble. It's a complicated world. We all have to go back to the drawing board, think about how we can do things differently and better.
Tursek's group will focus on protecting land and farms from flooding or droughts that may come with a warmer world. California has its own laws to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, and business investments in green energy technology like wind and solar power are at an all-time high. Meyer from the Union of Concerned Scientists says that if the United Nations climate bureaucracy is to have a role in these national efforts, this is their last chance.
I mean, I think it's kind of two strikes and you're out here, that if Cancun is perceived as a failure in the wake of Copenhagen, it really is going to be hard for the UN process to recover and get the political support it needs.
The Cancun conference winds up at the end of this week. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
The head of the Federal Reserve Bank is defending his effort to stoke the economy. The Fed's policy of buying up Treasury securities to push down interest rates is known as quantitative easing. That program has been criticized by some economists and foreign leaders who say it will do more harm than good. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports on one of the criticisms and how Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke responded on 60 Minutes last night.
At one point in the interview, Bernanke said he wanted to address something he's been hearing a lot lately.
One myth that's out there is that what we're doing is printing money. We're not printing money.
The charge goes to the heart of the Fed's efforts to contain the financial crisis, and economist Brian Bethune of IHS Global Insight says it's one of the big reasons why the Fed seems to be losing the public relations war.
This is something that, unfortunately, at this point, the Fed is not doing a good job of communicating this.
At the start of this downturn, the Fed tried to stimulate growth by cutting short-term interest rates it controls directly. But rates fell about as low as they could go, and the recession continued. This fall, with the recession supposedly over but unemployment still high, the Fed turned to quantitative easing. Under the program, the Fed is buying up U.S. Treasury securities. By flooding the Treasury markets with money, Bethune says the Fed wants to bring down long-term interest rates. That improves the balance sheets of businesses and makes credit cheaper for consumers.
They're raising the net worth of businesses and households, which raises their credit worthiness, which then means at some point banks will want to lend to them again.
But the program is expensive. The Fed has pledged to pour more than $600 billion into the Treasury markets, and that has led to the charge that the Fed is printing money. Where does the Fed get the money it's spending? Bethune says it's simple. It writes a check. The money goes into banks across the country and appears as reserves on their balance sheets. But Bethune says until the bank actually uses the money, it's not real cash.
The only way that that would translate into a general increase in cash in the economy is if they say, we're going to start to do more lending.
At some point, the economy will pick up and banks will suddenly realize they have huge amounts of reserves to invest and lend, and that will be a potentially dangerous time for the economy. With so much money flooding into the system all at once, inflation could skyrocket. Bernanke says inflationary pressures are so low right now, there's virtually no chance of that happening. And anyway, he says, once inflation becomes a threat, it will be easy enough for the Fed to reverse course.
We could raise interest rates in 15 minutes if we have to. So there really is no problem with raising rates, tightening monetary policy, slowing the economy, reducing inflation at the appropriate time.
But Alan Reynolds, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, isn't so sure the Fed will be able to gain control of the situation or whether it will have the political will to raise rates as much as necessary.
I consider it kind of a risky gamble, and so far it hasn't paid off because the market is scared of it, and as a result the dollar has gone down and interest rates have gone up. And that wasn't what they intended, but it is somewhat predictable.
Reynolds notes that Treasury rates have risen in recent weeks, and he thinks that's because a lot of investors are worried about the impact of quantitative easing. But Bernanke says what critics don't get is that the Fed has no choice but to act.
What I think they're doing is they're looking at some of the risks and uncertainties associated with doing this policy action. What I think they're not doing is looking at the risk of not acting.
In the interview, he talked about the nation's continuing high unemployment rate. It's a reminder, he says, of just how weak the U.S. economy remains and how sitting back and hoping for the best is not really an option. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Finally, it's holiday time, and if you're like me, you're probably enjoying a cookie or two or three, and maybe also because it's Hanukkah, a jelly donut on the side. And I don't know, maybe all that sugar is hyping up the Obama critics, who, not content to seek a repeal of health care reform, are now taking a swipe at the Obama's Healthy Eating Initiative. I read about this in Judith Werner's column last week in the Sunday New York Times. She wrote about how former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin decided to bring some cookies to share at a private Christian school she was visiting in order to, as she tweeted, intro kids to beauty of laissez-faire. Now let's look past the fact that as a private Christian school, the kids would not have had to follow the kinds of guidelines for school lunch that the Obama administration, along with a lot of parent activists, it should be said, are trying to bring to the public schools, which are the schools that 90% of American children attend. Can I just tell you, never mind that. It's that laissez-faire thing I was interested in, because it turns out that billions of dollars in federal funds are delivered every year to support the kinds of crops used to make, well, cookies. and the milk to go with it. The programs are part of what's called the Farm Safety Net, and these are payments to farmers and landlords which are intended to protect the farming community against economic risk. And they typically go to major commodities like wheat and corn, which will end up in that corn syrup in your pecan pie, and sugar, as well as the milk to wash it all down. And let's not forget the cotton for your Christmas sweater. According to a report by the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service published in July of this year, the combined outlays for Farm Safety Net programs have averaged $15.7 billion a year during the fiscal years 2003 to fiscal years 2010. That's not expected to change much in the next 10 years. Don't get me wrong, food security is important, so the economic well-being of the farmers who grow food is important. But to imply that the government has nothing to do with what we eat and how much of what we eat is laughable. On top of that, the level of support for some crops, traditional commodities like wheat and corn, far outstrips the support available for most fresh fruits and vegetables, let alone the kind of specialty crops or organic foodstuffs that have recently made their way into many markets and have become another thing for people who think they're real Americans to ridicule the smart set about. Now, I think it's worth mentioning that one of the reasons the Obamas, Mrs. Obama in particular, has taken on healthy eating is that so many Americans are not only overweight, they are obese. It's becoming a crisis in higher health costs and also in the alarming number of potential military service members who cannot qualify for military service because they're physically unfit. This administration's focus on healthy eating is in some ways going back to the future. Many people now forget that the school lunch program exists in part because too many kids in earlier generations were too undernourished to get through basic training. And now, of course, it's the opposite problem. Anyway, it's good to talk about what we eat and how much, if for no other reason than it's not just a private matter. The food we get, its quality and availability, is not just a matter of your own skill in the garden or with a shotgun. Now, that makes a nice story. That's not the world we live in. And yes, I will take that last chocolate chip cookie, if you don't mind. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.